You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Thomas Frank is the author of What's the Matter with Kansas and The Wrecking Crew. He's a columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for joining me, Thomas.
Anytime, Rick.
Thomas, let's start by playing Monopoly with Barry C. Lynn.
Yes. So he's written this book called Cornered. Who is Barry Lynn? He's a guy at the New America Foundation. It's a sort of a lesser think tank here in D.C., and he's a business journalist of a type that you don't come across every day. I mean, he's a serious business journalist. He's taken seriously in that world, and he's written a couple of previous books about, you know, the corporation and that sort of thing. And this one is a study of his new book, Cornered, is a study of monopoly, and, you know, where things stand with monopolistic practices right now in the U.S. economy here in the year 2010. And it's really scary, Rick, because if you're like me, you just sort of assumed that, you know, that the antitrust division of the Justice Department or somebody, you know, Federal Trade Commission, somebody was on the ball and making sure that that monopolies, you know, that companies aren't able to get monopolies, aren't able to build up a monopoly position in any, you know, particular field. And, I mean, first, the ugly facts. There's monopolies all over the place. And he gives...
It's like they're making the world safe for monopolies.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. Exactly. There's monopolies all across the economy in many, many, many different fields. I mean, he starts with one of the big ones, which is... Walmart, you know, it's obviously not a complete, you know, airtight monopoly on retail, but it holds a certain power over its suppliers. And if you live in, and he describes this power in great detail. It's kind of shocking that they're able to make Coca-Cola change their formula.
Really?
You know, not in regular Coke, but in some kind of diet product that they made. Yes, they were able to do that. And because Walmart is able to, according to this book, is to some degree able to interfere with the proprietary business practices of their suppliers, because that's how much power they have.
There's a horror novel called The Store by a gentleman named Bentley Little, which kind of turns Walmart into a front for the devil, essentially.
Oh, man. Well, this guy, Barry Lynn, wrote an article in Harper's a couple of years ago about Walmart and its the amazing power that it has in the market. And he also points out that years ago, the government, I mean, up until the 40s and 50s, the government used to break up chain stores. In fact, they specifically went after A&P. Remember the grocery store A&P?
Yeah.
That was the original chain store.
Mm-hmm.
And antitrust went after them several different times. And they are considerably small. They were considerably smaller at their height, you know, when antitrust broke them up, than Walmart is today.
Mm-hmm.
Walmart is much, much, much bigger and much more powerful. But Walmart is like the opening chapter of the book. I mean, there's monopolies in, or near monopolies, duopolies, oligopolies, you know, situations where you have one company or two companies or a handful of companies essentially controlling the market. And he's, you know, example after example after example. And it is shocking. I mean, there's even a popular there now about how to, search out and sort of, you know, solidify your grasp or whatever you call it on monopoly. You know, monopoly is what you want. And the really sick thing is, where are the people that are supposed to be looking out for us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why aren't they doing anything about this? And here we come back to one of my favorite subjects, which is, you know, the Wrecking Crew. This
mm-hmm.
is the what? Why is government not on the ball here? Oh, and by the way, I mean, we're forgetting one huge thing, and that's, of course, the power of investment banks. I mean, over the economy, it's sort of the original, economic stranglehold held by, in this case, you know, just a small handful of companies, too big to fail.
Too big to fail should mean too big to exist.
Exactly, and that's what antitrust was all about. That big is a threat. And okay, here's a funny thing. This author is not some kind of radical. This is what we forget about antitrust is that the antitrust sentiment is very deep in the American grain. I mean, mm-hmm. you're talking about Thomas Jefferson worried about monopolies, you know, and breaking up monopolies. You don't do it because you're a socialist. You do it because you think capitalism, you know, that capitalism has to be saved from mm-hmm. itself, basically.
Sure.
If you're pro small business and that sort of thing, then you should be in favor of antitrust. But what happened was during the Reagan years, they put these people in at the antitrust division who didn't believe in the mission. And they decided that from now on, the U.S. would only take antitrust steps against companies if you could prove that the company jacked up prices to consumers. That's the only case, the only situation in which mm-hmm. they will file an antitrust suit. And if they don't, if it's something like Walmart, which obviously brings prices down, you know, then there's no problem. And so they just stopped enforcing it. And here's what's really creepy. You know, it's a two-party system, right? You're supposed to have differences of opinion, right? That was the Reagan administration. The Clinton administration was like, well, we'll take this even farther, you know. And they allowed, unprecedented, concentration in all these different fields, namely in mass media, you know, electronics. Remember the Telecom Deregulation Act?
Yeah, the hacker crackdown, Bruce Sterling. Wrote about this a lot when they broke up the AT&T.
They broke up AT&T and then a few years later said, that was a mistake.
Uh-huh.
Let's go back the other direction. And now you have these incredible powers in the field of radio, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they did the same thing in banks and allowed incredible concentration in the financial services industry.
As they broke down the Glass-Steagall Act, which
exactly,
in retrospect, that was a very antitrust piece of legislation.
Well,
wasn't
the antitrust sensibility ran mm-hmm. deep in American culture back in those days, and you know it's as though it's just completely gone now. I mean, the anger is still there, and we distrust bigness. You know, but the idea that we should be breaking these companies up, which was, I mean, almost a religious thing 100 years ago,
mm-hmm.
has vanished from the scene. And this author makes Barry C. Lynn makes all sorts of arguments about why we should bring it back. And what struck me while reading this is how well this fits with the sort of mood of the moment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of the Tea Partiers here, you know, with their tri-corner hats and
the snake flags that you call
their
it.
Their anger at the big corporations that are basically able to write themselves a bailout, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they did, you know. Well, small companies go to the wall, but big companies got off scot-free. And one of the things that they used to say in the antitrust movement, and I opened my column with this quotation from Woodrow Wilson,
mm-hmm.
is that if a company... Or if it's possible for, you know, if someone in this country is big enough to own the government of the United States, they're going to own it. And it's like when I read that quotation, I forget where I found it, you know, it's 100 years old or whatever, but it just was very striking, you know, when you're talking about Goldman Sachs or somebody like that,
mm-hmm.
Wilson was describing exactly what is going on in our own day. That's why you have antitrust, not to, you know, make sure that consumers get lower prices. It's to make sure that companies don't rule the government.
The government.
The government stays on top. That's why you have it. Anyhow.
And that takes us to, gives us a nice segue to Mr. Glenn Beck, who recently opened his performance at CPAC, as you mentioned, with, "Hello, please, thank you, please be seated. I have to tell you, I hate Woodrow Wilson with everything in me."
And then he says, "God bless you."
God bless you, yes.
Yes, isn't that strange?
It's very peculiar, isn't it? Now, this is where you're talking here about the Tea Partiers and the rise of the rising right once again. Tell us about the CPAC and their reaction to this kind of anti-monopoly movement is what they've become.
Well, they don't even know about it.
Uh-huh.
This is something that it's completely lost. It's one of these cultural bits of American culture that's completely lost. There's a lot of things like that. Mm-hmm. The old solutions to problems that would solutions that would work really well today, that for whatever reason have been sort of pushed out of our culture, and especially pushed out of our politics. And so, the Tea Party people are interesting because their heart is in the right place on a lot of these issues. They don't like the big corporations. They don't like the bailouts. All well and good. Whether or not they want antitrust back, I bet it never comes up. I would be astonished if they were even, talking about it. But so Glenn Beck, who's their sort of ostensible leader, takes the stage at CPAC, which is the annual conservative get-together held here every year here in D.C., and he has denunciation of Woodrow Wilson, the who was this great antitrust leader 100 years ago. Now, I have my own objections to things that Woodrow Wilson did, in particular the Red Scare and also World War One, which was a terrible mistake. But in Glenn Beck's denunciation of Woodrow Wilson, it all has to fit together in this ideological, pattern.
It's history via ideology.
Exactly. Yeah, history by ideology. And by in particular this kind of libertarian ideology. And so Woodrow Wilson was a progressive. We all know that progressives were all about human intelligence guiding the economy through government, through the heavy hand of government. By the way, which is actually something that I believe in. I'm totally in favor of that these days. But so he's denouncing this, and then he holds Woodrow Wilson responsible for prohibition. When they banned alcohol in America with the constitutional amendment. And I was listening to that, and I'm like, that's strange. I can see how that would fit in the sort of libertarian take on progressivism, but it just takes a couple of clever Google searches, and you can find that, in fact, Woodrow Wilson was against prohibition, and Woodrow Wilson vetoed the Volstead Act, which enforced prohibition. He thought it was a bad idea. But the president that Glenn Beck loves, Calvin Coolidge, and he goes on at some length during a CPAC speech about how great Calvin Coolidge was. Calvin Coolidge is the president that we identify the most with prohibition. Calvin Coolidge did try to enforce it. He was bad news if you like beer. But that's just you're going to make mistakes like that if you understand history in that kind of ideological way.
They seem to be very interested in rewriting history, and the Tea Party kind of has, as you say, it seems like they have their hearts are in the right place, but they've just got their guns aimed at their feet.
There's a book about this, Rick. It's called What's the Matter with Kansas? You need to check it out. It's all about this. People who have these very democratic, very anti-elitist impulses, and everything that they do just makes the power of the elite that much greater. And that is totally what we are going through again right now. But I was having some fun with these guys this week in the Wall Street Journal. I don't know if you heard about this, there was a Republican National Committee fundraising document that got, it didn't really get leaked. It got, left. Mm-hmm. They were doing a fundraising event, not a fundraising event, but they were telling Republican fundraisers how to go about their business, how to raise money for the Republican Party. And somebody left their copy of the presentation behind in the meeting room. And so somebody else picked it up and gave it to a newspaper here in D.C., and they published it. And it is some hilarious or scary stuff, depending on how you look at it. And among other things, it refers to Republican small donors as, they're afraid. You have to ramp up their fear. You have to make them fearful. And then it said they're reactionary. This is the word that the Republican National Committee applied to their own donors, their own benefactors, reactionary. and it made me think early 19th century, after the French Revolution, the sort of you know, the royalists mm-hmm. coming back into power, you know, and, economic royalists.
And we have the paleos or urban caveman.
Yes, there's another. I mean, okay, we've got back railing against the progressive era and Woodrow Wilson and getting the story of prohibition all backwards. Then we have the reactionaries, the Republican Party referring to its own allies as reactionaries. And then there's a little light went on in my head, and I remembered a story that ran in the New York Times about a month ago, a little more than that, about this group of people in New York, this sort of subculture, and they're brought together by a diet. Okay, mm-hmm. It's the famous caveman diet where you eat a lot of meat, you know? By the way, I love meat. I eat tons of meat.
Mm-hmm.
You might even say that I'm on the caveman diet.
Yeah, I'm pretty close myself.
But this story is about people that take it a little bit farther. Mm-hmm. You know, and they live this entirely caveman lifestyle, you know, and they do caveman exercises, and they give blood, you know, because they have this idea that caveman, you know, Paleolithic man was often you know, had been wounded and lost a lot of blood.
Well, that's a really strange mix of technologies, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And then the hilarious thing is, so you're reading this article about this this subculture, and then it says at some point in the article, just this one sentence thing, you know, many of them identify as libertarians. And I was thinking, oh my God, it's, you know, caveman conservatism. It's this idea of stripped back to the state of nature, the economic state of nature, as well as the dietary state of nature. You eat meat, and there's no government intervention. Damn it!
Red in tooth and claw.
Yes.
And a civilization itself is bunk. You write, and I love that.
Well, I mean, they're against bread. You know,
They're against bread.
Bread is a Bronze Age affectation, Rick.
Is a Bronze Age affectation.
Well, that's how I describe it. But bread is, you know, it comes from agriculture. These guys are pre-agriculture.
They're just hunting. They're hunting and gathering.
That is the economic philosophy that I think that the right wants us to take is, you know, the caveman economics.
Saber-toothed tigers and woolly mammoths are thundering up and down Wall Street.
That's exactly right.
I've been speaking with Thomas Frank. He's the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, which is now a movie, isn't it, Thomas?
It is a movie. It's a documentary. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I'm going out to Kansas City today we're going to have a premiere of the movie in Kansas City. It's pretty good stuff.
And he's also the author of The Wrecking Crew and a columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for joining me, Thomas.
You got it, Rick.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.